final unit. Just two more chapters. And by the way, it won't be the way the syllabus implies it will be. It's not going to take 3 days to get through this chapter. In fact, I'll probably get almost through it today. The special census chapter is much longer, so that'll take whatever the rest of the time is. In any case, it's two more chapters for the final, and everyone should know by now that the final is not comprehensive. It is just test six, so just these two chapters. Also, show up when you're supposed to show up. It's not the normal time, which you should know by now because it's finals week. But anyway, we want to talk about the autonomic nervous system in this first of the two chapters for the final unit. Before we get to the first slide, though, let's reacquaint ourselves about how the nervous system is subdivided. Right? You have what are the two major divisions of the nervous system in general? No? Central nervous system and peripheral nervous system, right? Which is really an anatomical distinction, right? Because central nervous system is brain and spinal cord, and peripheral nervous system is everything else in the system. But then the peripheral nervous system we break down kind of functionally rather than structurally. And what are the major subdivisions of the peripheral nervous system? Sensory and motor, correct. Or afferent and efferent, right? We can then subdivide each of these. What are the divisions of the sensory division? Yeah, visceral and somatic. What's the distinction there? Visceral is for what? What does visceral mean? Well, it means of the viscera, but what are the viscera? They are the soft internal organs within the major cavities of the body. So intestines, liver, things like that are the viscera. Whereas somatic, even though it means body, is really referring to just part of the body, right? What is the somatic sensory division responsible for? Sensory information from what? Right, the non-viscera, the muscles and the surface. So that's the sensory division, which of course is conveying incoming information. The motor division is subdivided into what? Also visceral and somatic, right? And so what's the somatic motor division responsible for? Right, it's responsible for innervating skeletal muscles specifically. Any motor neuron is going to innervate at least a terminal motor neuron is going to innervate some sort of effector organ, correct? And effector organs are muscles or glands. Well, specifically, the somatic motor division innervates skeletal muscles only. So the visceral motor system innervates what? Glands and other kinds of muscles, including... Everyone hear that? Of course not. Right. Cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands are the effector organs, are the targets of the visceral motor division, which is a division of the peripheral nervous system, right? What's another name for the visceral motor division? Right, that's where we are. The autonomic nervous system is another name for the visceral motor division of the peripheral nervous system. Okay? So, that means the autonomic nervous system technically doesn't include any sensory neurons, right? But in this chapter, The title of the chapter is something like Autonomic Nervous System and Visceral Reflexes. In this opening slide, we're seeing a visceral reflex arc. But I just want you to understand that not everything in this visceral reflex arc is autonomic, is part of the autonomic nervous system, right? A reflex arc, whether it's visceral or somatic, is going to include, like we've talked about before, a sensory neuron and a motor neuron, both, right? Well, they're parts of the two fundamental divisions of the peripheral nervous system, motor and sensory. So even though we're talking about a visceral reflex arc here, only part of that anatomy is actually officially part of the autonomic nervous system, just the motor neuron part. All right? But as far as reflex arcs go, it's the same story as the ones we looked at before. You have to have a sensory neuron because you have to have some way, well, you have to have a sensory receptor first, because you have to have some way to transduce whatever the event is, like being touched in our previous examples, into an action potential. That's what the job of the sensory receptor is. You have to have a sensory neuron to propagate the action potential as a nerve signal toward the central nervous system, brain or spinal cord. There might or might not be an interneuron in the central nervous system. In this case, there's one shown, and it's inside the central nervous system. In this case, it's inside the brainstem. Specifically, what part of the brainstem is shown here? The medulla oblongata, correct? And then you have to have a motor neuron exiting the central nervous system, as you do here. But actually notice that there are two motor neurons, two efferent neurons in series here, a longer green one, and then right before it gets to the heart, another shorter green one. And then, of course, you have to have an effector organ. So really, the anatomy of the reflex arc is no different from how we studied it in the other chapter. In a visceral reflex arc, and we're only looking at one example here, but in general, for a visceral reflex arc, the sensory receptors are just free nerve endings that somehow transduce that event, like I said, whatever it is, into an action potential. So there aren't specialized organs like there were for other reflexes that we examined, for visceral reflexes. They're just free nerve endings. And the example that we're looking at here is a reflex arc that is responsible for the operation of a reflex for maintaining blood pressure. It's part of homeostatic regulation. Blood pressure is just one of several different variables that the body tries to keep from varying too much. It keeps it within narrow limits. Functionally, the fundamental difference between a visceral reflex and a somatic one is that you're not even aware of when these reflexes occur. Now, you don't really have control over any reflex, right? You get hit in the tendon on your knee is going to jerk. You don't decide to do that. So a reflex is stereotyped, always means it always has the same result. It's automatic. Same is true for a visceral reflex. It's just that you're not even aware that it's happening at all. Like you're aware when you're getting hit in the knee and you kick your knee, you can feel that happening. But you're not aware of, you don't have a sensation of the various things that are reflexively controlled by the autonomic nervous system. It's all behind the scenes. This is why this division is called the autonomic nervous system, right? What is autonomy? What does that mean? What is autonomy?
Doesn't
right. Autonomy literally means self-control. If a nation has autonomy, it's not ruled by someone else. It has self-control. So the autonomic nervous system operates without you deciding how it operates. Does it without your intention. It's subconscious and automatic. So it takes care of a lot of things that you should actually be glad you don't have to be thinking about. It's good that we don't have to consciously control the rate of the heartbeat or the blood pressure or how much secretion is being done by our digestive system at various points along the way. All of this stuff would just make studying for the test even harder, right? You don't have to think about that stuff. It's all done by the autonomic nervous system. But, like I was saying, for it to operate reflexively, it requires, of course, first sensory input. And that sensory input is not actually part of the autonomic nervous system. The output is. All right, so let's just look at this example. And even though it's the chapter title implies that we're going to look at several different visceral reflexes, this is the only one that we're really looking at. But it's just a general example that really gives you the idea. The other things, the only thing that differs is what is being measured. In this case, what's being measured is blood pressure. So there are sensory neurons whose nerve endings, which are the sensory receptors, like I said, are located at each of the two carotid arteries in a bulge in those arteries called the carotid sinus. Sinus is just a general word that means an enlargement. So the carotid arteries are pretty important arteries that deliver blood to your brain. And only one of them is shown here, but there's a left and right one. There's one that branches off of the first major branch of the aorta, which is called the brachiocephalic artery. That's part of 202. Don't worry about that name. But anyway, a branch of that brachiocephalic artery is the right carotid artery. There's also a left one. It's just not shown. They both, though, have a bulge in them called the carotid sinus. And in the walls of those carotid sinuses are these free nerve endings. Now, how is it that those free nerve endings are able to tell anything about the blood pressure? If you were designing this thing, of course, evolution isn't design, but if you were designing it from an engineering perspective, how could you sense what the blood pressure is in a vessel? Right. The higher the pressure, the greater the stretch, the amount of stretch in that artery, because arteries are elastic. So they're not like solid pipes that don't bulge. They balloon out each heartbeat, and the aorta itself does. And in fact, there are other receptors doing the same thing that just aren't shown here in the aortic wall. The aorta bulges out and then recoils. It actually kind of acts like a second heart and pushes the blood along the way. But anyway, the greater the pressure, of course, the more the stretch is. So there are nerve endings that are able to respond to that amount of stretch and produce action potentials, the frequency of which encodes the blood pressure. In other words, the higher amount of stretch is going to cause a more frequent chain of action potentials. They're going to happen more often. Remember, action potentials are all or none, so they're all the same size. If you need to give the brain information saying that the blood pressure is higher, you don't do that by making stronger action potentials. There's no such thing as stronger action potentials. They're all the same strength or magnitude. So you encode a stronger stimulus as a greater frequency of action potentials. And that's going through a sensory neuron. And notice at labeled number 2 that this happens to be part of the glossopharyngeal nerve, which should make sense to you if you still remember the functions of the cranial nerves. So the sensory component is traveling through one of the pairs of cranial nerves to get to the brain. The brain stem itself, and the medulla in particular, is a site of many nuclei that are important for autonomic function. All of these behind-the-scenes measurements that are being made and adjustments need to be reflexively made. A lot of that's happening in brainstem in general and in medulla oblongata in particular. Why do I call them nuclei? Because there are cell bodies in the central nervous system, right? And what is important about there being cell bodies? What happens at cell bodies? Integration, exactly. So that's why you have to have multiple neurons in a reflex arc, because you have to have integration. If it were just one neuron that goes all the way in a loop back to the target organ, there would be no difference in the output ever, right? There wouldn't be any integration. You have to have a synapse, at least one synapse, for there to be integration. And integration occurs where axon terminals come together with the dendrites that are connected to cell bodies. So that's why nuclei are important integration centers. All right, so the medulla oblongata is basically the site of the set point. The set point being what the proper blood pressure should be. And the set point is not constant. It depends on what you're doing. So there's a set point for blood pressure at rest that's different from the set point while you're jogging. It goes up and down depending on the needs. But just like you reset the temperature on a thermostat, set point, whatever it is at the moment, is what you want that variable to be at, right? So that's where the integration comes in. There's a comparison between the actual value and the set point. And if there's an error, then the output should seek to minimize that error. That's the essence of negative feedback, right? You want to negate the error, which is why it's called negative feedback. You want to reduce the error. And that's going to be done by making an adjustment ultimately to the force of contraction and to the speed of contraction at the heart via motor neuron that is part of, notice, a totally different cranial nerve. The vagus nerve, the wanderer, which is number what? 10, yes. That is the output of this reflex arc. And that's the part that is actually officially a member of the autonomic nervous system, right? Because this is the motor component of the reflex arc. So here's where it's a little bit different, though, compared to the reflex arcs we looked at before. Because before, there was a single motor neuron that went all the way to the effector organ, right? To the muscle. Here you have two motor neurons in series. And therefore, there's a synapse along the way. A synapse between an axon terminal and a cell body. So what structurally do you expect to occur there if there's a synapse? What kind of structure is that synapse going to occur in? What is it?
It's the SA node.
Well, it's actually not the SA node yet. The SA node is on the other end of the second neuron. So the second neuron is directly innervating the heart. You're correct. That's at the sinoatrial node, which is the pacemaker of the heart. But I'm talking about this connection right here, this synapse between the first neuron and the second neuron. What kind of structure do you expect that to occur in? Just in general, based on your knowledge of... Well, a synaptic cleft simply refers to the tiny little space between the neurons. I'm talking about a type of structure that's going to house this whole connection between these two neurons and others like it. Well, Let me phrase it another way to give it away. This is just one cell body for that one neuron. There are going to be others right along with it. Right? It's not just one reflex arc. There's many running side by side. So there's going to be multiple second neurons, each with a cell body that is being innervated by the upstream neuron. Therefore, what kind of structure should house that? No, I'm asking for the name of a structure that will house several cell bodies of these second neurons. No? Has anyone ever heard of a ganglion?
Yes.
Right? A ganglion is something that contains several cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system. We're no longer in the central nervous system. This isn't a nucleus. You told me about the nucleus up there because of its cell bodies, right? You're going to have a collection of cell bodies in a reflex arc for the autonomic nervous system because, unlike the somatic reflex arcs, there are two motor neurons, and therefore there's going to be a cell body somewhere out there between the central nervous system and the effector organ. That's going to be a ganglion by definition, right? A group of cell bodies. All right? So just like in a nucleus, a ganglion is going to be a site for possible integration. And that's what happens in autonomic reflex arcs, or reflexes, I should say. All right? Let's go to slide 2 and compare with pictures a somatic motor neuron going from the central nervous system to a skeletal muscle, which of course is the effector organ in all cases of somatic neurons or somatic motor neurons. Compare that to the innervation coming from the central nervous system for the autonomic nervous system. So this is comparing somatic motor division to autonomic motor or visceral motor division. Okay? The top should be review at this point, right? The cell body of the motor neuron lies somewhere in the central nervous system. In this case, since it's coming from the spinal cord, notice that that cell body is located in the ventral horn of the spinal cord gray matter, like we've discussed already. Recognize that as the ventral horn? Okay. A single motor neuron travels from the central nervous system all the way to the skeletal muscle. All right, so after that information leaves the central nervous system, no more integration. It goes all the way to the target. In the autonomic nervous system, like I just said in the previous slide, you have two neurons in series. And the connection point, of course, is where you're going to have a cell body. And like I tried to get you to say, that cell body and the others like it are going to be housed at a ganglion. So unlike the somatic motor division, the visceral motor division, or the autonomic nervous system, features a ganglion of some type. And we call those, in general, autonomic ganglia. But we're going to talk about different kinds of autonomic ganglia, so that's just the most general of the words. We're going to specify different kinds in a minute. Okay, but the scheme here is that the cell body, just like in the somatic motor division, starts out in the central nervous system, but notice it's coming from a different part of the spinal cord. It's the cell body is housed in the lateral horn of the spinal cord gray matter, which are the little bulges to the side when you look at the butterfly shaped dark matter in cross section. Okay, the lateral horn. So that's a nucleus. It's just like the ventral horn is, but they are nuclei of different parts. The autonomic nervous system for the lateral horn versus the somatic motor nervous system for ventral horn. Yeah.
Is there only one connection with the autonomic?
No, it's a good question. There is, in all cases, one synapse. Okay? In series. So there aren't two or more neurons, there are exactly two for all cases of the autonomic nervous system, okay? But where that synapse occurs is going to be in different places for different parts of the autonomic nervous system, which is why we have different kinds of ganglia that I'll eventually talk about. All those different kinds of ganglia, though, are examples of the general word, autonomic ganglia. Okay, now, since the ganglion is the connection point between the two neurons, we name these two neurons based on their relationship to the ganglion. And so we don't call them the upstream neuron and the downstream neuron, which I did just because I knew that made sense to you. We call them the preganglionic neuron and the postganglionic neuron, literally the one before and after the ganglion. Okay? Of course, the postganglionic neuron is the one whose cell body is part of that ganglion, right? It makes up that ganglion. Okay, so it's that postganglionic neuron that makes it all the way to the effector organ, whatever that is, the heart in this example, but it could be, you know, muscles in the iris of your eye. Could be glands in your anywhere in the body, and so on. So skeletal muscle, smooth muscle, or glands are the effector organs of the autonomic nervous system. We also have on here listed some neurotransmitters. And once again, the top should be review, right? The neurotransmitter used in all cases of the somatic motor division is ACH, which is what? Acetylcholine, correct. So we've already talked about acetylcholine being released from synaptic vesicles to diffuse across the cleft and then bind to acetylcholine receptors in the skeletal muscle. That's how it works in all cases of that division. In the autonomic nervous system, there are two releases of neurotransmitter. There's one at the ganglion, of course, because the preganglionic neuron is going to release its own neurotransmitter. And then there's also going to be a release at the target organ because that postganglionic neuron is going to release its own neurotransmitter, right? Notice from the picture that in all cases of autonomic neurons, in all preganglionic autonomic neurons, it's acetylcholine again. Okay, so no choice here at the ganglion. It's always going to be acetylcholine. The postganglionic neuron, however, is going to release either acetylcholine or norepinephrine. And by that, I don't mean that it decides which one it wants to release. There are some postganglionic neurons that always release norepinephrine, which is what NE stands for. There are some other postganglionic neurons that always release acetylcholine. So it just depends on the neuron, the postganglionic neuron. But those are the two possibilities. Okay? Let's go on to three and compare these things in tabular form. So this compares somatic and autonomic nervous systems, as you see. We've already talked about the fact that the effectors are skeletal muscles in all cases of somatic, and their glands, smooth muscles, and cardiac muscle in autonomic. Now notice that control under somatic is listed as usually conscious, I mean usually voluntary. And that's because the vast majority of cases it is voluntary. You decide to move a skeletal muscle. But as an exception to that, there are skeletal muscles in your two ears, in the middle ears, stapedius muscles, as they're called, that attach to the stapes, one of the three auditory ossicles, or small bones of the middle ear. And those get reflexively contracted or relaxed in response to how loud the sounds are around you. For instance, a loud sound is going to contract the stapedius muscle so that it stiffens up the stapes and therefore will protect your eardrum from getting too much vibration. Well, you're not deciding to do that. So it's an exception to the voluntary rule for somatic. The vast majority of cases, though, it's a voluntary control. And autonomic is usually involuntary. It says usually here because it almost always is involuntary, but there are techniques that humans can use, like meditation, for instance, that can at least indirectly modulate or adjust the workings of autonomic of systems. So you can, for instance, it's possible to consciously but indirectly lower your heartbeat, for instance. Normally it's behind the scenes completely, though. We just talked about the neuromuscular junction being the only synapse that occurs in the somatic motor division, whereas there are going to be two synapses in the autonomic, right? One at the ganglion, one at the effector organ. We talked about the acetylcholine being the only one in somatic, and there's a choice, norepinephrine or ACH. I shouldn't say choice. There's two possibilities. Notice that effect on target cells, something we didn't talk about this time around, in somatic is listed as always excitatory. All right? So this goes along with what I've said several times, mostly in lab, right? Which is that the only thing a muscle can do on its own is to contract, right? Well, when you send a nerve signal to a muscle, that's what you're doing. You're exciting it. You're causing it to contract by exciting it. The only other thing you can do is not excite it. Just turn off the action potentials, and it will relax, right? In other words, you don't turn down skeletal muscles. You just fail to turn them on. Whereas in the autonomic nervous system, you can ramp things up or ramp them down both. Okay, you can, for instance, the reflex arc that we looked at that adjusts heart rate. You can turn heart rate up or down using the autonomic nervous system, whichever is appropriate for maintaining homeostasis. All right, that's a major difference functionally speaking. And the effect of denervation, what is denervation? Denervation. What does that mean? Cutting the nerves. Right. If you cut a heart out of the body, it will continue to beat for a while. Why is that? No, there aren't any, without any signals traveling. I mean, if you just, instead of just grossly cutting out of the body, if you just carefully sever all the nerves from the heart, and therefore definitely is not receiving any more signals, it will still beat. No, it's not receiving any signals. Neurotransmitters are the signals. What is it that you already learned about cardiac muscle that allows it to beat on its own? Autorhythmicity, right. Smooth muscle and cardiac muscle is autorhythmic, meaning that it will intermittently, or periodically, I should say, contract on its own without any signal. And so a heart that's been severed of nerves will beat a human heart an average around 100 beats per minute, which is faster than it's beating at rest. Well, this shows you that the autonomic nervous system at rest is really telling the heart to slow down, beat more slowly than it would on its own. On the other hand, if you sprint 100 beats per minute, it's not going to be enough. And so that same autonomic nervous system is adjusting the heart in the other direction. It's telling it to increase beat faster than it would on its own. Okay, so that's this denervation hypersensitivity just refers to the fact that the target organs are working on their own without that input, but at a faster rate than they would at rest. Okay, now to four. Well, there are two branches. We've already branched three times in this nervous system, right? Peripheral nervous system is one branch. Motor is a branch of the peripheral. Visceral motor, which is the autonomic nervous system, is a branch of the motor. The autonomic nervous system itself has two branches. What are those? Correct. Sympathetic and parasympathetic. Now, sympathetic really gets its name because it literally means feeling together. Pathetic means feeling, sim means together. And this, the reason this is a good name is because output from the sympathetic division affects a lot of stuff at once. In other words, what we have here is one upstream neuron, which you already now know as a preganglionic neuron, can branch, as axons can, right? Collateral axons. And therefore synapse on several postganglionic neurons, each going to a different organ. What do we call this? When one upstream neuron innervates several downstream neurons. One upstream neuron innervating several downstream neurons. We've talked about this wiring scheme before. Divergence. Good. Right. Coming apart is divergence, right? So one upstream neuron of the autonomic nervous system, or preganglionic neuron, is able to synapse on simultaneously, because of its own branches, several different postganglionic neurons, and those postganglionic neurons can go to different effector organs. So this is why we really call the one division sympathetic, because this divergence means that a single original signal can have several different effects. And therefore, the body is feeling this all together. That's why it's called sympathetic. The parasympathetic division gets its name based on its relationship to the sympathetic, right? Para meaning next to. All right, so what do you know about the sympathetic versus the parasympathetic divisions? No. The sympathetic division is often called the fight or flight division. Now, what do you mean by fight or flight? A lot of books use this term, and a lot of students like to repeat it, but what does it actually refer to?
When a stimulus surprises you, the autonomic reaction.
Right. Fight or flight refers to, the reason it gets its name is because it's the way the body prepares itself for a stressful situation. If you're threatened, for instance, by some other animal, which could be a spouse or whatever, a bear, then you immediately have two choices in the according to the phrase, right? Fight or flight. Either one of those, if you're going to stand there and fight whatever it is that's threatening you, you're going to need increased blood flow to skeletal muscles. You're going to need to be alert. You need to be on your toes, right? But you also need that if you decide it's wiser to just get the hell out of there and flee. So that's fight or flight. They both require the same preparation of the body. Alertness, readiness of the muscles, increased blood flow, and therefore increased heart rate. All of those things are results of activation of the sympathetic division of the autonomic nervous system. While you're doing that, some things that are important can actually be put on the back burner, right? Like digesting the meal you might have just recently eaten. You can say, okay, I'll digest this a little bit later after I reach safety or after the fight is over. So during fight or flight, digestion and urination and things like this are considered to be less important, and so they are toned down. All right? The parasympathetic division, on the other hand, if you activate the, if you increase the output of the parasympathetic part of the autonomic nervous system, then it's really the opposite of fight or flight. Now it is time to get back to the digestion, for instance, which is a really important function, right? We tend not to think about food after we've eaten it, but the digestive system is truly vital. The rest of your body works unless it's getting nutrients continuously. So parasympathetic division ramps up activity of the digestive system, urinary system, and so on, and kind of relaxes you. Your skeletal muscles aren't given as much blood. You feel tired, not as alert, right? Like after the Thanksgiving meal, right? It's time to just take a nap and digest. So, in one sense, the parasympathetic and the sympathetic divisions can be thought of as being antagonistic, but that's not a hard and fast rule. Sometimes they're working together. Often, though, they are working antagonistically. It's also not proper to say that the sympathetic division increases things and the parasympathetic division decreases things. Both divisions increase some things and decrease others. Right? So in the fight or flight or response, it's blood flow to the skeletal muscles that gets increased, it's heart rate that gets increased, it's digestion that gets decreased. But in the parasympathetic output, it's blood flow to the skeletal muscles that gets decreased, it's heart rate that gets decreased, it's digestion that gets increased. So they both increase and decrease things. They just usually do it in kind of a reciprocal or antagonistic way. That's functionally a distinction. In slide 4, we can see there's an anatomical distinction as well, or at least it'll be more clear once we look at the next, the corresponding slide for the parasympathetic division. But here we're looking at just the sympathetic division, and you have the brain and spinal cord listed there, or shown there, with color coding on the spinal cord. Keep in mind that the spinal cord has cervical, thoracic, lumbar, sacral, and coccygeal regions, even though the spinal cord doesn't go all the way down the vertebral canal. Remember that? So the coccygeal region, which would be the very tip, bottom tip of the spinal cord, does not occur at the coccygeal part of the vertebra, vertebral column. Okay? They have their own boundaries. But what's shown here that's important about the sympathetic nervous system wiring is that the sympathetic neurons that make up the sympathetic division of the ANS all, first of all, arise from the spinal cord, not the brain, just the spinal cord, and moreover, only from the thoracic and lumbar regions of the spinal cord. So notice the connection points are only where it's purple and orange, which are labeled as thoracic and lumbar regions. So all sympathetic output comes from one of these two regions of the spinal cord, but on either side of the spinal column, so outside of the bone, on either side of the spine, there are ganglia, which are examples of autonomic ganglia. But this is the first instance of a specific type of autonomic ganglion I'm going to give you. These ganglia are arranged like links in a chain, notice. There's one chain on either side of the spine. And these are therefore called sympathetic chain ganglia. All right, so let me just tell you that there are three major kinds or categories of autonomic ganglia, two of which are used and therefore are part of the sympathetic division, okay? One of which I just gave you, sympathetic chain ganglia, first type. Second type are called collateral ganglia. Those are also part of the sympathetic division. Yes. The third major and final category of autonomic ganglion are the ones that are only that are part of only the parasympathetic division. And those are called terminal ganglia. So we'll see those in a different slide. Here, though, we see both types of sympathetic ganglia, the chain ganglia making up the two chains, and then the ones that get specific names, but they're all members of the same category, the celiac ganglion, the superior mesenteric ganglion, and the inferior mesenteric ganglion. Those are all examples of collateral ganglia. Okay? Now, the fact that there are two types of autonomic ganglia in the sympathetic division should not confuse you into thinking that there's more than two connection points. There's still only two neurons. And so there's only going to be one synapse between preganglionic and postganglionic neuron. It's just that that's going to happen either in a chain ganglion or a collateral ganglion. Or one other exception that I'll talk about in a minute. Okay? What I'm saying here is that in the same string of the same series of neurons, it's not going to be the case that you have synapse at a chain ganglion and then another synapse at a collateral ganglion. It's going to be one or the other. And therefore, that maintains the rule that I told you about on slide two, that there's just one connection point between the first and the second neuron. Okay. So the chain, notice, is much longer than each chain is much longer than the places that these sympathetic neurons originate at the spinal cord. There are usually, there's some individual variation, but there's usually 23 pairs of sympathetic chain ganglia. So each chain has 23 links in it. And those links go all the way from cervical region to coccygeal region, even though the neurons only arise from the thoracic and lumbar parts of the spinal cord. And the reason is that neurons, the preganglionic neurons, can, once they are in a ganglion, continue either up or down the chain until they finally synapse with the postganglionic neuron. Okay? You see what I'm saying there? It'll be more clear on a different picture, but that's why that's why you have all regions of the sympathetic chain, whereas you only have thoracic and lumbar regions of the spinal cord involved. Okay. I think that's all I wanted to talk about on this slide. Let's go to slide five now and take a closer view. Now, on this slide and this book refers to three possibilities with respect to the routing of these sympathetic neurons. So this is, once again, this slide is only for the sympathetic division. There's actually four routes, though, that I want you to know, because there's a special case of what they're just calling route three. So it's since it's fundamentally different, I'm dividing it into four possibilities. It all starts out the same in all four routes, meaning the preganglionic neuron has its cell body located, like I said earlier, in the lateral horn of the spinal cord gray matter. That's why you have all of the green ones that are representing different routes. They're all starting out the same place. Okay? Now, they're not necessarily all at the same level, right? They could be anywhere in that thoracic or lumbar region. but they all start out there in the lateral horn of the spinal cord gray. Since the autonomic nervous system, and therefore the sympathetic division of the autonomic nervous system, is itself a division of the motor division, it should make sense to you at this point that all of these neurons, whatever the route is, are exiting the spinal cord through a ventral rootlet, right? Because motor information exits the spinal cord through ventrally, not dorsally. Dorsally, that's where the sensory information enters the spinal cord. Okay? So rootlets combine into roots, right? I mean, into a root, a ventral root. So each of these green neurons is running through a ventral root corresponding to a region of the spinal cord that is where it's originating. Okay? That's what that bundle of axons is right as soon as you get out of the spinal cord. That's a ventral root. Ventral root and dorsal root come together, remember. So the connection point where they continue is what? What do ventral and dorsal root combine to form? Spinal nerve, right? The spinal nerves are where the two roots come together at that position. So, and notice that spinal nerve is the one that has the little circle showing you what it's indicating. So that little section is the spinal nerve at that level. All right? And notice that in all four routes, this first part is the same. So the preganglionic neuron is going to travel through a part of the spinal nerve after it goes through the ventral root. Then it gets to things that branch off of the spinal nerve. And notice that there's two little branches coming out toward the front here. And notice that they are called communicating rami. Rami is the plural of ramus, a word I already told you about. What does ramus mean? Remember when I said it's the same root as in the word ramifications or ramify? It means branch. Ramus means branch. So there are two little branches here of the spinal nerve, both of which, notice, lead to a sympathetic chain ganglion. So we're outside of the spinal column now. This is outside of the bony part because we've passed the spinal nerve. These two communicating rami are called that because they communicate with or connect with the chain ganglion. But notice that one of them has a different name compared to the other. So there is a white ramus and there's a gray ramus. Why do you suppose they're called that? What's the difference? What makes the difference for the color? Myelination. Exactly. Okay, so this preganglionic neuron, which we're still part of, notice that it travels, it leaves the spinal nerve through the white ramus to get to the chain ganglion. This makes sense because of something I didn't actually tell you yet. The preganglionic neuron in the autonomic nervous system is myelinated. The postganglionic neuron is not. Okay? Since we're still in that first neuron, that preganglionic neuron, we haven't come to the terminal yet, it makes sense that all of these fibers are myelinated, and therefore it makes sense to call this specific communicating ramus the white ramus. So in terms of information flow, information is flowing through the white ramus from the spinal nerve toward the chain ganglion. Here's where there can be different possibilities depending on the route. Okay, all of that up to the sympathetic chain ganglion is the same for all four routes I was going to tell you. So the first possibility is that the preganglionic neuron ends at this chain ganglion that it just entered. And that's represented by where the number one is. Notice the axon terminal in green, synapses with the cell body in red. And that occurs in the chain ganglion itself, which is why that thing is called a ganglion, because it has cell bodies in it. The cell bodies of postganglionic neurons. I just told you a little bit ago that postganglionic neurons are not myelinated. So the red one has no myelin. And notice that it will leave the chain ganglion through the other communicating ramus, the gray ramus, which is called that because the postganglionic neurons are not myelinated. And what it's doing is basically going right back to the spinal nerve that the upstream neuron came from. But now it travels through the rest of the spinal nerve and whatever branches it branches into to get to whatever effector organ it gets to. Okay, remember, in all cases, the postganglionic neuron is going to be in direct contact with the effector organ. So there is no third neuron. That goes the whole rest of the distance. That's the first possible route. Does that all make sense? Okay, the second possibility, like I said, it's all the same up to the entrance into the chain ganglion. The second possibility is that that neuron can either ascend or descend the chain, that preganglionic neuron. So it doesn't end at that chain, at that ganglion. It can go up to another level or down to another level, which is why you can have the chains cover all the regions, whereas you only have thoracic and lumbar at the spinal cord. And so the number two illustrates that. That preganglionic neuron came in at the number one but didn't end there. It went up the chain to another ganglion and then had its synapse with the postganglionic neuron. Okay? So that's the second possibility. The third possibility is that it's once again the preganglionic neuron does not end in the chain ganglion that it entered, passes through it. But in this case, it doesn't pass up or down the chain. It instead takes a different exit from that chain ganglion. This little branch coming from this ganglion where the number three is, notice that is labeled as a splanchnic nerve. Splanchnic is really just another word for visceral. They both mean the same thing. Splanchnic means inner. The innards are the viscera. But anatomically, what makes a splanchnic nerve officially is that it connects two autonomic ganglia, a chain ganglion and a collateral ganglion. Okay? So the collateral ganglion here could be any of several. Like I said, the collateral ganglia have specific names, but in general, they're all part of the same category, collateral ganglia. This third possibility then is that once the preganglionic neuron makes it to the chain, the sympathetic chain ganglion, it exits that same chain ganglion through a splanchnic nerve and travels to the second kind of sympathetic ganglion, which is a collateral ganglion, which is where it ends. You see that ending right here and synapsing with a red postganglionic neuron. Okay. This also, by the way, means that splanchnic nerves are white as well, right? Because they're made up of preganglionic neurons, which are myelinated. The postganglionic neuron that starts at that collateral ganglion then travels the rest of the way to the target organ. That's route number three. And that's the only three possibilities that this book recognizes. But I told you I'm giving you a fourth possibility because there actually is a fourth possibility. Not shown here, but I'm going to explain it. The fourth possibility is only happens in one specific target organ. which is the adrenal medulla. What is the medulla in general? The deeper part, right. So there's the adrenal gland is made up of two layers, the adrenal cortex and the adrenal medulla. The adrenal medulla is the only target organ that route number 4 uses or goes to, okay? So the difference here, it's just like route number 3. In other words, it goes through the splanchnic nerve to get to a collateral ganglion. But when it gets to that collateral ganglion, it still does not end. It passes through the collateral ganglion, this preganglionic neuron I'm talking about, so the green one. It travels through the collateral ganglion and goes all the way to the adrenal medulla. So you might think that this is an exception to the rule that there are two neurons in series, right? Preganglionic and postganglionic. Well, the adrenal medulla, even though it's part of the adrenal gland, is fundamentally distinct from the adrenal cortex. They not only produce different hormones, but they develop from totally different tissues. And they contain totally different kinds of cells. And the collection of cells that make up the adrenal medulla actually are modified neurons. They're not glandular cells, really. They're neurons. And by modified, what I specifically mean is that these neurons that make up the adrenal medulla don't have any dendrites or axons. So they look like regular run-of-the-mill cells, glandular cells, just little spheres, but they are actually neurons, and they release neurotransmitters, just like neurons do. They release chemicals, just like neurons do. What's different is that they don't act as neurotransmitters. A neurotransmitter is not called a neurotransmitter because of which chemical it is, but how it acts. A neurotransmitter is released just locally. It's only applied or released to that tissue that is being innervated. A hormone, on the other hand, which could be exactly the same chemical that was used as a neurotransmitter in a different instance, a hormone is released not locally but globally. It's released into the bloodstream and therefore gets broadcast throughout the body because the blood carries it everywhere that there are cells. Okay, so that's a functional distinction, not a chemical one. So these modified neurons of the adrenal medulla, they're just really a bunch of cell bodies, right? Because that's really the only thing that is their whole neurons, just all cell body. So since they're all cell bodies, what technically is the adrenal medulla? It's a specific, it's technically a ganglion. It's technically a sympathetic ganglion of a different type. We just don't consider, I told you there are two types the sympathetic neuron, sympathetic division uses. Well, the adrenal medulla is just a special case on its own. So, the reason the rule isn't broken about two neurons is that in this fourth route, the preganglionic neuron, the myelinated one, travels through the collateral ganglion, continues all the way to the adrenal medulla, and then ends. And the cell that it connects to, or the cells, because it branches, those cells of the adrenal medulla, in other words, those are the postganglionic neurons. Like I said, they're modified neurons. Okay, so in both cases, in all cases, you have a pre- and a postganglionic neuron. So the target tissue really is not the adrenal medulla itself. The adrenal medulla is the collection of postganglionic neurons. The target tissue would be the blood into which the hormones that are created by these neurons that make up the adrenal medulla are released. Does all that make sense? Do you understand why that's fundamentally different from the other three routes? Yeah, go ahead. Well, there are generalizations about where the targets are for the different routes, but they're just generalizations, so there are exceptions to those for one thing. And for another, I don't think it's important for you to memorize those destinations, so I'm not going to even tell you about them. I just want you to know those are the four possible routes. And remember, this is all sympathetic. None of this had to do with parasympathetic at all. Sympathetic is the only part of the autonomic nervous system that uses as actual synapses the chain ganglia and the collateral ganglia. The parasympathetic division, like I said earlier, uses terminal ganglia, which are that third category of autonomic ganglia. Okay. In slide 6, a table kind of summarizes some of what I just was talking about. Actually, this kind of answers your question as well, but depending on which collateral ganglion gets used, there are batches of target tissues that correspond to that. So the, there are more than just these three collateral ganglia, but these are the three major collateral ganglia. So these are the ones that I not only mentioned earlier, but you should know the names of these three major collateral ganglia: celiac, superior mesenteric, and inferior mesenteric. Celiac, by the way, same root as in coelom, which means and I can't think of the word. Cavity. It means cavity. So the celiac gets its name because, well, it, actually the celiac ganglion gets named for its proximity to what's called the celiac artery that branches off of the aorta. But that in itself gets its name because it goes to three major places, the stomach, the spleen, and the liver. And the stomach is a cavity. And so that's why it got that name. Anyway, the celiac ganglion is a major example of a collateral ganglion. Superior and inferior mesenteric, of course, get their names for their placement with respect to each other, but mesenteric means middle of the gut. Meso means middle, and entero means gut, so the intestines and associated structures. So you can see that the celiac ganglion, the neurons go, arising from the celiac ganglion go to stomach, spleen, liver, like I said, the same things that get blood from the celiac artery. But I don't really want you to memorize these things. I just want you to realize that depending on the route that we just, the four routes that we talked about, there are generalizations as to where in the body it's going to go to. So it's not just totally random spaghetti-like network. They are going, you know, kind of makes sense anatomically is what I'm saying. But don't bother memorizing where the specific target tissues are. 7. Well, I included this slide just to show you a picture of what I was talking about. The thorax is above, off the screen, because the top of this is the diaphragm, which is the official boundary between thorax and abdominal pelvic cavities. So, as the aorta descends from the heart, the part that's in the chest still is called the thoracic aorta, and then once it pierces through the diaphragm, then it continues as the abdominal aorta. And there are some major branches that come off of this aorta. The first major one in the abdominal pelvic cavity is the celiac trunk. A trunk is just an artery that's pretty short before it branches itself, okay? Which is exactly what happens. That major branch itself immediately splits into three things: one that goes to the spleen, one that goes to the liver, one that goes to the stomach. But the celiac ganglion is just named for its proximity to that celiac trunk. And it's a major collateral ganglion. There are other ones named here as well, the superior mesenteric and inferior mesenteric. And notice that they all pretty much line up in front of the spine, the spinal column, the vertebral column, which isn't shown here. But notice that it's in front of the spinal column. Whereas the chain, each chain is to the side. And that's why these things have different names beyond the ones I just gave you. Another name for the chain ganglia are the paravertebral ganglia, next to the vertebrae, to the side, in other words. Another name for the collateral ganglia are prevertebral, meaning in front of the vertebra, the vertebrae. So if you see those words, because this book uses, it goes back and forth, calls them collateral ganglia sometimes and prevertebral sometimes, calls them chain ganglia sometimes and paravertebral sometimes. So those are just synonyms for the same thing. Oh, but the other main point of this is to show you the adrenal medulla. You can clearly see that this is an example of an organ that has two very different layers, right? Adrenal cortex and adrenal medulla. Notice where the adrenal glands are. They sit on top of each kidney, right? Which is why they get their name. Renal means of the kidney, right? Adrenal means on the kidney. So adrenal is really just a word that tells you where they are located. Now, the cortex, like I said, is its own set of tissues. It secretes its own set of hormones. What do all those hormones have in common that are released by the adrenal cortex? Does anyone know? And I don't expect you to know because it's a 202 question, but does anyone happen to know? Examples of things that are released by the adrenal cortex? They are all steroid hormones. So glucocorticoids, which are called corticoids because they come from the cortex of the adrenal gland. Estrogen and progesterone, and testosterone are released there. Those are all steroids. They all come from cholesterol, right? That's been modified. Totally different set of chemicals compared to the ones released by the adrenal medulla, which is considered, which I'm considering part of the autonomic nervous system, unlike the cortex. So, those ones I do want you to know about, those chemicals. There are three hormones that get released by the neurons that make up the adrenal medulla, but almost all of the output is just two of those three. Does anyone know what those three are, though? Adrenaline, did you say? Is one. Well, why do we call adrenaline adrenaline? Actually, we don't call it. The British do. A lot of Americans tend to use it non-medically. You know, that's out there, the adrenaline rush, for instance. But scientifically, adrenaline is the British word for it. But what does that word mean? Well, it's named for the fact that it comes from the adrenal glands, right? Meaning on top of the kidneys. Adrenaline, adrenal. What is the American word, though, for adrenaline? Epinephrine. And notice what that word means. Nephric is another word that means of the kidney. The kidney is made up of substructures called nephrons. So nephric and renal really mean the same thing. Epi means over. So epinephric means over the kidneys, and therefore the stuff that's made by the thing that is over the kidneys is called epinephrine. Epinephrine is just the American name for adrenaline. They are the same thing. There's a very related chemical with a very related name. In the United States, it's called norepinephrine. That's the second of the three adrenal medullary hormones. The nor prefix, by the way, comes from chemistry. Nor just means that a methyl group is replaced by a hydrogen. So instead of a CH3, it just has an H. Otherwise, the whole molecule is the same. And so norepinephrine and epinephrine are only different in that methyl group. Okay, so that's why it gets its name. What is the corresponding British name for norepinephrine? Noradrenaline. Okay, correspondingly. So those two make up the vast majority of the stuff that's released by the adrenal medulla. But there is a small amount of a third hormone made by the adrenal medulla, and that is dopamine, which also works in the brain. But dopamine works out in the body, outside of the central nervous system as well, for various reasons. So I have to quit there.